Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, everyone. Today we've got Dan McNeil with us. Dan is Director of Engineering at Comply Advantage. Welcome to the show, Dan. It's really good to have you join us today. Thanks for this.
Cool. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. I mean, we'll get the ball rolling here just about if we could get a little bit about your background of engineering and how you got to where you are today as Director of Engineering.
Yeah, cool. So I did a maths degree. And then doing a maths degree, the two options were either accountancy or software development. I mean, they're the two standard options. And I didn't really fancy the accountancy route. So to be honest, I kind of fell into software development because it was the option that wasn't accountancy. And I took a job as a software developer, and I was a software developer for a few years. But it just became obvious to me that I was surrounded by people whose passion was development and was so much better at it than I was. And I was never going to be a superstar developer. So I gradually found myself moving more and more into what I call coordination tasks and more general, not problem solving in the code, but problem solving with the team or more abstract problem solving. And then I discovered that the passion other people had for code, I had for people leadership.
Amazing.
And that was a thing that really kind of sparked the flame. And I actually, this is what I enjoy doing. And then I moved into that. And I've been pretty much there ever since. I've been through quite a few industries. You know, I moved down to London and first took the step into people leadership in the mobile industry back, for anybody who remembers it, in the days of when Symbian was a mobile OS.
Wow.
That's where I worked.
Back in the day.
Yeah, that's aging myself a bit. So I worked at Symbian for like 9 or 10 years and then did a few other things and have gradually taken on broader and broader people management roles. And I think because that's what I enjoy, I think I found something that I'm good at. You know, I look around the team now and I see coders and architects who are much better than I was ever going to be in that role.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that in almost every career, really, if you find what you enjoy, then undoubtedly you're pretty much going to be really good at it as well. It's interesting that you've found that.
I think the motivation is there. If it's something you enjoy, the motivation is there to educate yourself, to learn, exactly, to develop. Whereas if it's something you don't enjoy, you don't have the motivation to get better at it, I find.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to be passionate as well. Would you say that you've navigated your career? I mean, it sounds to me like you kind of have. Well, you kind of have. You've made choices and stuck with them. Would you say that you've consciously done that, or like with everyone that I speak to in the tech career, it seems that everyone kind of bounces around different things?
I wouldn't necessarily just say I've bounced around, but I wouldn't say that I decided when I was 18, 21, you know, when I'm starting or finishing university, that I want to be a senior engineering leader and I'm going to do the stuff to get there.
Yeah.
I think the way I've got here is just to say every time I take a step, every time I make a move, is that a move in a direction I want to go?
Mm.
So it's less about having the whole path charted, but just making sure every time there's a fork in the road, you take the one that excites you. And I think if you do that, you'll find the way, even if you don't know the destination. I mean, I've already aged myself with talking about Symbian, but I'm not that old. I don't know what the future holds. You know, maybe my future is to be VP and CTO. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Isn't that exciting, though? Because I find with technology, you can kind of go anywhere you want, really, it seems. Mm. You're never just on one completely straight path ever, really, unless you decide that's what you want. But it's so rare these days.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the interesting thing is that tech is still a developing industry.
Mm.
There's still new stuff happening all the time, and not just new stuff in terms of tech. There's people trying new business models, trying new ways of working. That I don't think I'm somebody who chases a job title.
Yeah, that's good. You know, that's great.
I think I'm somebody who, I mean, don't get me wrong, sometimes you're in organizations where job titles matter. So I have in the past had the conversations where I said, look, in order to get the respect, the influence, or whatever, I think I need that job title. But that's because the organization demands it rather than I do. I think for me, it is exciting that people say to me, well, do you want to move on to be VP? Do you want to move aim towards a CTO position? And I think, well, probably, but it's less about the title and it's more about the kind of challenges that role would involve. And actually, you can get those kind of challenges with another job title, especially if you go to a startup where you might get a head of title, or you go to an organization where VPs and CTOs are kind of more distant is the wrong word, but they're not in the day to day. They're more people management or board level abstract leaders or whatever. And that's fine. Every organization's different. I think I'll always want to do a job where the primary part of my role is to lead a group of people, not a large group of people directly, because you can't do that. So, for me, the growth has come through leading a group of people directly to leading a group of people indirectly, through managers. And I think that for me was a very interesting thing to go through, because there was certainly a learning experience there in how to set the direction and influence the flow of a group of people without taking control. And that's always been very important to me, that you don't need to take control to be a leader.
That's really interesting. And I find it fascinating, actually, because I talked to quite a few leaders on the podcast, but it surprises me so much how much kind of, not even psychology really, but how much like how much you have to look within yourself really about who you are as a person, which I never really thought. I never thought management or leadership would be like that really until I started doing these interviews.
Yeah, I think for me, it's the reason why we need people to do it and can't do it all via spreadsheets and machines. Because if you think about all the competing priorities that you have in an engineering leadership position, you have the business needs. You have what are the products and the streams that need investment. So therefore, you need the people to go and work there. But also, you have the people's interests and career development. And you need to marry the need to deliver what the business needs with the needs of the individual. You can't just take somebody who's really enjoying on working on one thing and throw them at something they hate because the business needs it. And I think traditionally you might have done, I've been in some places where that is what happens, and you end up with a workforce that don't have any passion about, at best, you end up with a workforce who don't have any passion about the work. And at worst, you end up without a workforce at all.
Yeah. Do you think in recent years though, businesses, I'm going to say business and technology, do you think they've cared more about the individual than they ever have done? You think, is it quite archaic when we talk about, like you were just saying then, get the business need, do what the business needs, and you're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this, and that's it, not really caring about personal development. Now it's quite a recent thing where we care about people more.
I think it is, but I think it's had to be. And I would love to say that the reason you've got the bigger companies, there's some, I'm going to mention them by name because I'll get myself into trouble, but there are some very large tech companies who have a reputation for burning people out. They drive them and drive them and drive them and burn them out. And the reason why those tech companies are having to shift that is pure economics. And I think that a lot of what I would describe as the ethical change in society, so making a better society that cares more about well-being and cares more about people, is great. But what's ultimately going to drive that into businesses is going to be the economics of it. And I don't like the method that we're driving it, but frankly, if it gets us in the right direction, I'll take it. And I think that the reality we've seen with hiring, at Comply, we've been hiring a lot, and we've seen that it's a very candidate-driven market at the moment. And that means that candidates have a choice.
Absolutely.
And no longer can you, as a business, presume that the candidate will be grateful for having received this morsel of a job offer and they'll come, a bit like in Oliver, going, oh, yes, please, can I have that?
Yeah.
That's long gone. Actually, candidates are demanding in a good way. Mm-hmm. Candidates are saying, this is what's important to me, and I'll get 6 offers on the table within 2 weeks of starting interviewing, and I'll pick the offer which best meets what I want. And very rarely is money the top of that list.
Yeah, it's really easy just to throw money at it, isn't it? And go, well, we'll pay you 10 grand more than the other five places. But then they go, well, no, the structuring isn't what I like. The role isn't exactly what I want. So you're right. It is very candidate driven.
I was going to say, I don't, you know, all this stuff we're talking about caring about people.
Yeah.
Doesn't cost any money. So I've never understood why that's incompatible with paying people more. You know, yeah. It's not like caring about people to a certain extent it does, because managers have to spend more time on the people. But in macroscopic terms, it doesn't cost a business any more to be a good place to work.
Yeah.
So why should people have to sacrifice market rate salaries in order to, for their well-being work? Because you can have both.
Yeah. But then again, you have to employ or, you know, have good leadership, though. That's so important, because if without good leadership and good management, the people aren't going to be driven or cared about or, you know, feel listened to. And that's hugely important. So you've got to have so much going at the same time to make a business, you know, successful and work, you know, organically almost. It's really important. There's so much to not overlook, you know.
There is. And the other thing is I've been interviewing a lot for engineering managers at the moment, because Comply is a growing organization and we need managers and leaders as well as we need the individual contributors, because they need somebody to do all that stuff we've been talking about. And the interviews for that have been interesting, because you get people who, you know, speaking openly about it, you get people who like being a manager because it's more money or because it's a title or whatever. And I'm not really, that's not the kind of leader I would want in the organization. I want somebody whose passion is making a space where people can do well. You know, I was talking to a candidate the other day, and the way we were describing it is, you know, the sport of curling.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like the manager is the person in front with the brush clearing the way. They don't actually touch the stone, but they've just got to clear the way so the stone goes in the right direction and flows smoothly. And you can't do that if your approach is to grab hold of the stone and move it.
That's true. I like that analogy a lot, you know.
You can have it. Go on, use it.
I'll always quote you, Dan, and then you can invoice me every time you hear it.
Okay, yeah.
But no, so you mentioned hiring, and this is a really interesting point that I want to, you know, talk a lot about. And first of all, I want to talk about hiring, you know, management. So you were saying it's not just engineers that you hire, it's hiring leadership, leaders and managers. Are those two completely different things to hire for then?
Not completely different. I think that the attributes that you would look for in a manager and the attributes that you'd look for in a developer, there's a whole range of attributes. You know, when you're hiring anybody, you have like a whole range of attributes and you think for this role, that one's more important than this one and that one's more important than this one. But I think the things that you would expect in a good leader, like not taking control unless it's appropriate. Now, there's some situations like customer outages, for instance, I think it's fine to take control, but generally, somebody doesn't take control, somebody who communicates well, somebody who's open and transparent, somebody who cares about people. Actually, they're all things that are important in a senior developer or an architect as well. So you'd weight it differently, because a senior, you know, a Comply, and most places I've worked, we don't expect senior developers to be line managers because they're very different skills. But there's a lot in common. I think that the difference for me is that I think manager and leader interviews need to be more thorough. Now, I'm not saying that we don't care about dev hiring. That's not what I'm saying at all. But the broader the sphere of influence somebody has, the more costly it is to make a hiring mistake.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, that's true. If you hire an individual contributor into a team, you want them to fit in, you want them to do well, you want them to succeed. But if they don't and it doesn't work out, the blast radius is quite small.
Yeah.
If you hire in a senior manager responsible for a team of tens of people and it doesn't work out, the blast radius is really quite big.
Yeah, wow. I've never really considered that, to be honest with you, but it's so true. You're mentioning at Comply that you hire quickly, or at this stage in its lifetime, you're hiring quickly. And we're talking about hiring managers and engineering managers and leaders, but how do you also hire quickly and also ensure that you're hiring diversely? Because in this day, well, always hiring diversely has got so many benefits for the business. How do you then, because hiring diversely takes time and energy and resources. So how do you ensure that you don't let that slip, that you always continue to hire diversely?
For me, it's about doing the groundwork. It's about doing the stuff to get a diverse pool of candidates before you're in the full flow of rapid hiring. Because if you're hiring like 20 people a month and you come up with a diversity initiative, which opens up a new strand of candidates to you, you know, whether that be going out to a place that has greater gender diversity or going out to somewhere which has greater socioeconomic diversity or whatever. Generally, those initiatives aren't instant. There are instant things you can do to increase diversity. You can reword your job ads. You can advertise in different places. You can reach out to different people. It's some instant things. But the real stuff that makes the fundamental change takes time to kick in. So if you wait till you're hiring 20 people a month before you decide, right, we're going to go and talk to this organization about getting more female candidates, and that takes 3 months to kick in, well, you've hired 60 less diverse candidates before that kicks in. Now, it's better than not doing it at all, because after that 3 months, you'll be hiring diversely. But even better is to think about this when you're not hiring at speed, to think about this from day one. So you're saying, yeah, right, we need to scale up. We know that to scale up, we need to increase our pool of people working on recruitment. We need to increase our pool of interviewers. We need to make sure we've got a slick interview process. You can tune up the process, but actually at that stage, I think you do also need to say, and what are we going to do to make sure that these aren't all cisgendered, white, straight, affluent men? And you need to think about that at the start of the process, because to a certain extent, you know, if you're doing hiring in 2021 and you want to do something now to change your diversity stats for the year, it's a bit late.
Yeah, definitely.
Three quarters of the year is almost gone.
Yeah.
But having said that, doing anything is better than doing nothing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this is, I think there's the thing with diversity, let's take gender diversity because it's, you know, it's one to talk about, but as I mentioned, there's plenty of others. There's a small percentage of the overall developer population that's female. So not every company is going to be able to exceed the average for female developers. For every company that's above the average, a company is going to be below the average.
Yeah.
And we fixate a lot on every company saying, well, we're going to get 20%, we're going to get 30%. And it's actually impossible for every company to do that because there just isn't that number of female developers to go around yet. So
yeah,
for me, that's great. And companies should definitely strive to have the same opportunities and the same conditions. And I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but just make the workplace so that it works for everyone. But actually, I think we need to solve the root problem. And the root problem is not people attracting more diverse candidates and getting their gender diversity stats up. The root problem is that there are not enough diverse candidates to go around, so it's impossible for everybody to get the gender diversity stats to where they want them to be. So I think we have to think towards the future. And as a tech company, we're hiring now. We're starting to think, you know, companies will be starting to think about 2022 hiring plans. That's great. But as an industry, we need to think about the girls who are currently about to choose their A-level subjects.
Absolutely, yeah.
And are not going to hit the job market until 2025, 2026, whenever it is, however long their education is. Unless we make some fundamental changes, we're never going to be out of this situation of companies chasing the relatively small number of female engineers.
Well, exactly. And it is about future-proofing the industry, essentially, in this with gender diversity. And it's like you said, you know, there's young females now that are in the point of choosing their A-levels, but there is that drop-off of interest when girls get to that age in technology. And I just wonder what the tech industry can do to kind of help solve that, because, you know, there's all sorts of things like role models and female role models and all those kind of things. But what's actually going to keep them interested and make a real difference?
I'm going to answer that question by not answering it. And I'm going to answer that question by saying, I'm not sure two men are the best people to answer that question.
Absolutely, yeah, you're right.
So what we should do is we should talk to some of the women that are in tech and, mm-hmm. you know, talk about their journeys and help them become role models. We should also engage as a tech industry with the girls who are about to choose their A-level subjects yeah. and find out what's happening for them. What's their decision process?
Yeah.
Because I have no idea what it's like to be a 16-year-old girl choosing my A-level subjects because that never happened to me. So let's yeah. talk to somebody who has got that experience.
Yeah, definitely. It makes complete sense, actually. But it is. I mean, you say that, but it is all about those conversations with those people who are living it. And it's something that the tech industry does have to seriously consider. You know, we've got a future proof.
It does. And it's not just gender diversity. You know, you have... a big one at the moment is neurodiversity. And again, that's not something you can flick a switch. You can't kind of stick a stamp on your website to say, we consider neurodiversity with a flashy logo and go, right, problem solved. It's about thinking, what can we do to make the process more accessible for everybody?
Mm.
And again, it's about talking to the people who might be put off, talking to the people who aren't applying and say, what's going on for you? What could we do to make this better? And, you know, there are organizations, there are people who've done that research who can share it, but fundamentally that information needs to come from the people who are in the group who are not represented.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can talk about socioeconomic diversity as well. I mean, most people who go to university have come from relatively affluent parents. And I don't, you know, that's not always true, but generally, if you can afford for, if you have several kids or whatever, and you can afford for them all to go off at university, you've probably got a professional job. You've probably got a decent income. What about all the kids whose parents don't have that? What do we do for them? And what about people in other situations where university isn't the right thing for them? It could be personal situations. It could be whatever's going on for them in their life. It might be that university at 18 is not a fit for them.
Mm.
And we have to be careful not to exclude them from the tech industry just because they didn't come in via the route that we think is traditional. And, you know, one thing that I've tried to do in my teams over the years is make sure we employ people who don't have computer science degrees. I mean, we employ some people who do, that's fine. But I don't want everybody in the team to have a computer science degree. It's good for some people to have that theoretical background, but not everybody needs it. But we still find ourselves hiring people who've got different degrees. So a degree in criminology or a degree in psychology or a degree in archaeology or economics or whatever. We're still hiring for people who've got degrees. How about the people that don't?
Mm.
And I think it's I'm saddened by the number of job adverts that still say must have a good relevant academic qualification. I'm thinking, why?
Yeah.
Surely what we care about is how good they are at doing the job we want them to do, not what decisions they took as an 18-year-old.
Exactly. And actually, it's not just about giving, you know, people opportunities that wouldn't have had them previously. It's more, there's way more than that to it. There is that as well, but there's more to it than that. What are the benefits you can see if you hire diversely instead of non-diversely?
I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say this carefully because I don't want this to come out badly. The reason for hiring diversely isn't because female developers have some magic thoughts that male developers don't. The point is, every individual has different thoughts and different way of thinking. And if you only target 30, 40% of the market, you're missing out on 60 or 70% of the life journeys and experiences of people there. So for me, gender diversity is a good proxy for saying, are we getting people from across society? is everybody in society able to contribute in every area of life?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we got to a world where 50% of the dev community was female and that was normal, we'd probably go and look at something else, because to be honest, we'd probably still be missing another chunk of society. But we're doing so badly at it at the moment that we're vastly underrepresenting women. So sorting that out feels like a good place to start. But for me, a diverse team, people bring different life experiences. They bring different professional experiences. They bring different ways of thinking. They bring different cultural philosophies. Sounds like a really big and slightly, you know, slightly weird word to use, but different upbringings will encourage people to think that different things are important. And so they will bring the things they consider are important to the table during a discussion that somebody else might not. And it also comes to, you know, this point we were saying about, if you want to find out why there aren't many women coming into dev jobs, talk to women and they'll have the answers. You can't do that unless they're in the room. So you need a diverse team in order to get the views in that will allow you to understand what's happening in the part of society that you're not representing.
Mm. Yeah. Are you hiring remotely at the minute? Is that?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
So then, you know, pre-COVID, were you hiring remotely at all?
Not really. There were a few odd cases, but not generally.
So then has this situation of being able to hire remotely, with its, you know, benefits of being able to, you know, cast a wider net and open yourself up to a larger pool of candidates, has that made it easier then to hire diversely?
Yes. But it's also made it easier to hire diversely for every other company that's now hiring remotely. So yes. And having a remote workforce means that actually you can introduce people back into the workforce who might previously have been excluded. But hiring remotely doesn't give this company any competitive advantage in hiring over any other company that's hiring remotely.
Mm.
It certainly gives us all an advantage over companies that aren't hiring remotely. But, you know, when we talk to candidates and we say, obviously, you can work from anywhere in the UK, that's fine.
Mm.
To be honest, that's no longer considered a benefit. That's just like, yeah, I know, I was expecting that. And it's almost, if somebody doesn't say that, if somebody says, we expect you in the office 4 or 5 days a week, the candidate will hang up the phone.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
But yeah, I mean, generally, on the point about getting a more diverse workforce overall rather than for an individual company, yes, absolutely. Because, you know, take a very simple example, but a parent of any gender who's doing the school run,
mm-hmm.
if they do the school run and then go to the office, that tends to take a bit of a chunk out of the day. So if you have a lone parent doing the school run at both ends of the day, it might even be difficult for them to get enough hours in the office during the day because it's kind of squeezed at both ends. But if they're working from home, actually, it's not a problem anymore because they're back at home before the working day starts and they'll, you know, say on Slack or whatever at 3:30, popping out to do the school run, back in a bit. And suddenly you've opened up the job market to people who might have thought that they weren't able to be included in it because, you know, parental responsibilities or other caring responsibilities or anything else in their life cuts into the day, which means that if you're at home, you can take 10 minutes to go and do something. If you've got, you know, you have a relative living with you for whom you're a carer, you can still attend to their needs sporadically during the day whilst working from home. But if you're in the office, you couldn't do that.
Do you think that remote working on this scale would have ever happened without COVID, without being pushed into it?
It's crazy, I think,
isn't it? Because it shows we can live, we can do it absolutely fine. It's crazy, isn't it, to think that it's taken this long, well, taken something so big as COVID for this to happen, especially in the tech industry.
It is. I think that the tech industry was better in that before COVID, I was working one day a week at home and quite a few people in the team were as well and whatever, but it was seen as a privilege. It was seen as a kind of, oh, you're working from home. That's interesting. I think that, but big changes in society are quite often built upon shocks.
Right.
Progress, general progress, tends to be quite slow. For instance, a great prompt for the change in the laws around same-sex relationships in the UK came from there were a spate of bombings in London quite a few years ago now, just by kind of a guy who didn't like anybody who wasn't like him. And there was a pub in Soho that was bombed and some people died. And actually, the partners of the same-sex partners didn't get the same recompense as people in an identical situation who were different genders. And that was a kind of shock that went, right, out of this terrible situation, we've got to fix something.
Yeah.
And I think quite often it takes something quite shocking that makes us, that forces us to think differently. Because how often in our daily lives do we take the time to think differently? How long do we take the time to say, what if I didn't do this thing in the way that everybody's been doing it for 50 years? I tried doing it another way. You need to have bravery, you need to be entrepreneurial, and you need to be very rich. You know, if you're an Elon Musk, great. You can go and do things very differently. But if you're not, it's very hard to say, I'm going to do this very differently, because the whole structure of work, both economically, but also logistically in terms of office space and landlords who had office space, who were plugging office space. And, you know, when you're working for a company, people say, where's your office? You know, it was just ingrained that this is the way businesses look. That actually it's a shame that it's taken something shocking that's forced us to change the way we think. But actually, I think in a way that was inevitable. And if it hadn't been COVID, it would have been something else. There would have been something else that happened that forced people to say, actually, we can change the way we work fundamentally.
Yeah, I'd hope so, because especially with startups and how easily we can communicate with each other now. I mean, you know, you mentioned Slack and things like that. And it, you know, when COVID hit, it was literally, for some businesses in technology, it was overnight that you could just go, right, everyone take your computers and work from home. And it was that easy. And then communication is exactly the same. We've got, you know, Zoom calls, which have literally just become huge in the past year. It's just, you know, we're on a Zoom call now. You know, maybe back in the day, we'd have been in a room doing this. You never know. So,
yeah. And it's things like, my mother had never heard of Zoom before the pandemic. She would not have known what Zoom was. Whereas now, Zoom has become, it's become a bit like Hoover. You know, Hoover's a brand name, but everybody describes it as a Hoover.
Yeah.
It's become a bit like, we're doing it on Zoom. We're doing a Zoom quiz. And actually, it's not always Zoom that's the actual technology.
But yeah.
I mean, I think we did go pretty much, I say we went overnight to remote working. We didn't, because we're not stupid. We could look around the world at what's happening. We could see the writing on the wall. We knew it was coming. And so we were kind of prepared that when the email came in to say, right, it's now London's turn. It's Thursday. Take everything home that you need. From Monday, we're going to be working remotely and you'll need permission to come into the office. Kind of knew it was coming. We kind of all been preparing our home working spaces.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the shock was how long it went on for, because I remember when we were all headed out to the office, we were like, okay, I'll see you in 6 weeks. I'll see you in a month. Be back in September. We'll see you in the summer. None of us thought this was going to last 18 months. I don't think anybody did.
Yeah. I remember at that period of time when, you know, I remember one of the guys in the office was saying, oh yeah, it's going to be 3 weeks. We're going to be out of the office for 3 weeks, working from home for 3 weeks. I was like, no, that'd be ridiculous, honestly. And he was like, yeah, that's what's going to happen. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to go crazy. And then after kind of like 2-3 week mark, I thought I was going insane just being at home for 2 weeks. Little did I know, over a year later. And it's like, you know, you actually get, it's crazy how quickly you get used to things, isn't it? But
well, my other half's worked at home for years. So for him, this wasn't that different. But what he did say was people in his company, it's a completely remote company, started waving to each other at the end of Zoom calls. They'd never done that before. It was a completely remote company. But suddenly, with the pandemic, like, by then, which they'd never done before. So it's changed, I think, the culture of even companies that were remote beforehand. I think the other thing, and I've talked about this before, is if you're hiring remote people, you're hiring people who've made that decision to be remote. So their mindset, their logistics, their setup, their geography or whatever is set up for it. We didn't hire this, you know, my team, we have since the hiring we've done this year, but the team that we had in March 2020 had not been hired to be remote. So they've been hired to be the kind of people who wanted to work in an office. So actually, there's something we can learn from teams that were already completely remote, but I think it is a fallacy to say, oh yeah, we've always been working remote, therefore it's easy. Actually, it's not, because these people didn't sign up for that. That's not what they wanted to do.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And it will be really interesting in a couple of years' time to see, you know, how many people are still enjoying remote working and how many people are, how that kind of balance weighs out eventually, you know, when people might get a bit sick of remote working and desperately crave being back in office, or if it goes completely the other way and so many businesses start up without even the thought of an office in their mind. You know, startups these days, I imagine they're not going to even bother with a premise. Why would they?
I think before all this, WeWork was struggling, weren't they? They'd overshot themselves. They'd opened too many premises. You know, a bit like, look what's happened to Zoom since this. I think this might be the savior of WeWork, because I think the model will be companies will pay for a few passes to have a bit of space, but they're not going to invest in dedicated space for themselves. But there's still something in people that likes being around other people.
It's good to have individual balance there, because it has so many benefits, I think. Just especially because if you're working from home all the time, even though you can do Zoom calls, and the point, I think there's a benefit of Zoom calls, but it's also a bit of a negative. One of the benefits is if you have a Zoom meeting, it's more concise.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say there was, last week, I've been in the office 1 or 2 days a week for a while now. And last week, we had a lot of our exec team over from the US. So our exec team is split between UK, US. And it was the first time they'd actually been able to travel. I mean, they were loaded up to the hilt on PCR tests and face masks and whatever, but they came over to the UK. And a lot of people came into the office, and we had our first properly hybrid all hands, where there was a room pretty much full of people in London and a load of people on at home as well. And there genuinely was the buzz I'd missed of bumping into people you haven't seen, having a chat with people. But I think the flip side, if you know, talking about neurodiversity, I'm not somebody who thrives on a lot of social interaction. I find it very, very tiring.
Yes, I'm very similar to you in that way, Dan.
So it's great to have the buzz of a day in the office, but then it's really great to get and have 2 days at home without it and reflect on it and go, well, that was nice. But I'm not one of these outgoing, bubbly salespeople who's, you know, around everybody all the time and feeding off the energy.
Yeah.
That ain't me.
I am totally with you on that. So I need my time at home. I'm completely with you. I mean, that's the thing, is individuals finding a balance about what's right for you. Yeah, for me, I'm similar to you. 1 or 2 days max in the office, and then the rest of the time is just by myself.
I've got 3 days in the office this week, so let's see how that works for me.
Yeah. I don't want to keep you here too long, Dan, even though I'm really, really enjoying this and I could literally chat to you. We've literally just scraped the surface with this. But it's also at the same time, it feels like we kind of put the world to rights as well.
But isn't that what podcasts are for?
Exactly. But before I let you go, I want to do a quick thing here. So I've jotted down a few words, keywords that we've spoken about, and I want you to give me your immediate thoughts on them. A bit of like a wordplay reaction kind of thing. Diversity.
Incredibly important.
Yep. Leadership.
More difficult than most people think it is.
Yeah. Engineering.
An art, not a commodity.
Very good. And finally, Zoom.
Love to hate it.
All right, Dan. Well, you've passed the test.
Cool. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed that.
What do I get? Do I get a prize?
Yeah. What do you want?
I don't know. Another cup of coffee?
Yes. I'll send you a cup of coffee. All right, Dan. Well, I really enjoyed that. That was really interesting and really well, just a really interesting conversation. So thanks for taking the time to do it. It's like I said, there's a lot to talk about, and we could have spoken for at least another hour or two. But yeah, for now, thanks, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Cool. Thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.